Now I'd like to start this morning's message with a story. It's a story about a church where the preacher told his congregation, "Next Sunday, my sermon will be on the ninth commandment, do not lie." And in preparation for my message next week, I'd like you to read Mark chapter 17 before coming to the service. Following Sunday arrives, and he asks the congregation, "So how many of you managed to read Mark 17 in preparation for today's sermon?" Most of the congregation raised their hands. "That's great news. Well done," replied the minister. "There's only 16 chapters in Mark's gospel. Now for the sermon on the sin of lying." So, what's the limitation here in this commandment? It's no false witnesses. The boundary line or limitation of this ninth commandment says no false witnesses. Exodus 20 verse 16, depending on what translation you're working with, it says, "You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You must not testify falsely against your neighbor," the New Living Translation. Or as the contemporary English version puts it, "Do not tell lies about others." Now, as with all commands of Scripture, it's important that we read them in context so that we can more accurately apply them to our own context as 21st century Christians today, as we seek to be obedient to those same commands in our lives. So the setting of this command is quite straightforward. It's in a court of law. What is prohibited here is falsely testifying against someone. For example, saying that you saw someone commit a crime when they didn't. Or conversely, saying they didn't commit a crime when you know full well that they did. That is false witness. In other words, it's telling lies. And in the Old Testament, in that society where a punishment for a crime could be capital punishment, telling lies in court could be fatal. Even today, honest witnesses in a court of law are an essential aspect of our justice system. It's no accident that outside of the church, the only public space where the Bible is regularly used is in court when people swear an oath on it to tell the truth. Perhaps you saw Boris Johnson doing that very thing at his hearing in the Common Privileges Committee this week, where he was giving evidence about whether he did or did not deliberately mislead Parliament over the Partygate scandal. Remember, you saw him, he placed his hand on a copy of the King James Version of the Bible, and he made an oath. He made a promise that the evidence he would give would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I don't know if you saw the Question Time TV program the very next day in Stafford, where they asked the audience that were mainly conservative voting people whether they thought Boris Johnson was telling the truth or not at that hearing. And he asked them to raise their hands if they thought he was telling the truth. Not one person in the audience raised their hand. It's quite telling, isn't it? So it's also quite revealing about how many people are prepared to tell an outright lie just to get themselves out of a tight spot. It's that disregard for truth and honesty that has become such commonplace that most people either we just shrug our shoulders and say, "Well, everybody lies, don't they?" Or worse still, we don't even bat an eyelid because we don't notice it. We've become so used to it. It's like the small boy in Sunday school who was asked what a lie was. And he said, "A lie is an abomination in the eyes of God." And then he added, "And our very present help in times of trouble." In the context in which this command was given, giving false witnesses or lying was regarded as a very serious offence. In Deuteronomy chapter 19, we read these instructions. "If a malicious witness comes forward and accuses someone of a crime, then both the accuser and the accused must appear before the Lord by coming to the priests and judges in office at that time. The judges must investigate the case thoroughly. If the accuser has brought false charges against his fellow Israelite, you must impose on the accuser the sentence he intended for the other person. In this way, you will purge such evil from among you." Now, this meant that if you were a false witness in a case that had, say, for instance, the death penalty attached to it, then the cost would be that you would be put to death rather than the person you falsely accused. And so you see how serious God takes this offence of lying. And God's displeasure at lying extends beyond the confines of a law court. In the book of Proverbs, God commands us, have nothing to do with lies and misleading words. And then the verse that Noah read to us a little bit earlier on, the Lord detests lying lips, but he delights in those who tell the truth. Now, as with many of the other Ten Commandments, when we're faced with this particular boundary, this prohibition, this limitation of not to lie, there's a tendency that our minds go straight to the extreme violation of the commandment. And we measure ourselves and our actions against that. So we can determine that our little climbing over the boundary isn't really that bad compared to what another person has done. So, for example, when we think about not committing murder, we think of people like, I don't know, what Putin's doing at the moment in Russia, or Adolf Hitler, or Ian Brady, or Fred West, or Harold Shipman, people like that. And compared to those people, well, our hatred of others, well, it's not as bad as that. When we think about not committing adultery, we perhaps think of those friends or family members who've cheated on their spouse and ruined lives and destroyed relationships within their families. And compared to our lusting after others and our use of online pornography, well, it's not quite as bad as that, is it? And when we think of this command not to lie, we think about maybe, as I just alluded to, Boris Johnson's lie about Partygate, or Putin lying to the Russian people about what's really going on in Ukraine. And compared to those lies, our little white lies are not really as bad as those. And if we're honest, to a certain extent, I would suspect that most of us think like that. And it therefore kind of makes it okay for us to continue in our little lies compared to those big, massive sins of lying in that way. It's okay for us to take one little step over the boundary compared to those who've leaped completely over the fence and gone way beyond it. Take, for example, this image here. It's a fence at a popular viewing platform over the rim of the Grand Canyon, with a couple of 1,000 feet sheer drop on the other side of the fence. Will it make any difference whatsoever if this numpty here takes one little step over the fence, or whether he runs and launches himself over the fence as far as he can get? Will it make any difference? It won't, will it? Absolutely no difference whatsoever. The consequences are the same. A boundary has been broken. And it's the same with the commandments in the eyes of God. There's no little breaking of the boundaries and then some really big breaking of the boundaries. You either overstep the boundary or you stay within the boundary that God has provided there for you for your own protection and your own blessing. And when it comes to this command about not lying, there's no acceptable lies or untruths. Truth exists. It's only lies that need to be invented. And the ability to lie is always a liability and always has a cost associated with it. It's estimated that in the UK, lies connected with social security benefit fraud cost the UK about £3 billion a year. Tax losses to the inland revenue from undeclared incomes are estimated to be about £35 billion a year. Lies on false insurance claims cost the UK about £2 billion a year. Probably some of that we pay back through increased premiums. It's interesting that underreporting your income or overestimating an insurance claim, well, that sounds much better than to say we've lied about it, doesn't it? Truth decay has an enormous detrimental impact on society and family life. Lies breed cynicism. Cynicism erodes trust, whether that be at work or at home or in society. I don't think it's any coincidence that an epidemic of lying has been accompanied by unprecedented levels of breakdown in families and marriages and relationships. If you think about it, all our social relations are formed on openness and trust. And when lying occurs, neither of those things can last very long. I think one of the most destructive aspects of lying is the way in which it accelerates other evils, whether that be theft or marriage breakdown, or violent crime or whatever it might be. In all of these things, lying makes it worse. Where there is truth, evil can be exposed and it can be dealt with. But where truth has been replaced with lies, then every sort of evil can flourish. As somebody once appropriately described it, sin has many tools, but a lie is the handle that fits them all. Sin has many truths, but a lie is the handle that fits them all. So lies are not just evil in themselves, they also encourage and become the fertile ground for other wrongs in our lives, in our relationships, and in society. And that's why God hates lying. Why he regards lies as an abomination in his eyes, and we're to have nothing to do with them, as the Proverbs say. And in contrast, truth is society's antiseptic. It can often be painful to apply, but it's very effective at stopping infection and disease. And truth is strong no matter how weak it looks. And lies are always weak no matter how strong they look. So we know that God hates lies. We know that we have a tendency to minimalize our little lies compared to those huge big lies that are out there, that we regard as having more consequences than the way in which we lie sometimes. So let's have a look at some of the ways in which we can be prone to bearing false witness, different types of false witness and lies. So firstly, there's the outright lie, the most obvious kind of untruth. This is where it's a complete fabrication of the truth, what we call a barefaced lie. The kind of person my old nan used to say of them, they've got more faces than the town hall clock, and not one of them tells the right time. This is the most, I guess, the most spectacular examples of this kind of lie. Things like Lance Armstrong, the world champion US cyclist, who for years denied he was using performance-enhancing drugs, and he absolutely destroyed anybody who said he was, only for, in the end, the truth to come out that he had lied all along. The US president lying that he had had inappropriate sexual relations with a female White House aide, only for the truth to come out that he had done. Or lies told by newspaper owners and editors that they have never hacked anybody's phones, only for later it to be found out that they've been doing so for decades. These are the big, significant, outright lies that none of us here in this room ever do or tell. But these are just the tip of the iceberg, really. For every one of big, spectacular lies like that, there are a million little baby lies where people like you and I tell complete falsehoods. I was going to call you, but your phone was engaged. I was going to do that thing, but I wasn't very well, so I couldn't do it. Oh, I'd love to come along to that event, but unfortunately, I've got something on that day. Oh, I did send that email, but it must have got lost somewhere. Or I was going to reply, but it's that email you sent 2 weeks ago, but I've only just found it in my spam folder. Have you ever noticed how convenient it is to use computers or technology as vehicle for our lives because they can't speak for themselves and share their side of the story? So there's no such thing as a baby lie. C.S. Lewis said, a little lie is like a little pregnancy. It doesn't take long before everybody realizes. And this is why we not only need to stay clear of outright lies, but we also need to refrain from half-truths. Now, a half-truth can be a really clever way of achieving the same effect as an outright lie, but with less risk and effort, by which we don't give the full picture. However, when a half-truth is presented as a whole truth, it becomes an untruth. Remember that courtroom application of Boris Johnson and his oath and promise this week to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God? I have a feeling that Boris Johnson might be needing quite a lot of God's help at some point in the future. Only telling part of the truth is one way of bearing false witness. For example, you may have been walking down the path here at the side of the church in the manse earlier this week, and you might have overheard Cherie and I having a bit of a row in the back garden. Then you come to home group later on in the week, and you might tell me, oh, Wednesday, I was walking past the church manse there, back garden, and oh, Tim and Cherie were having this almighty row on Wednesday afternoon. Ah, oh, it was glorious. The fact that you lingered a little bit longer in order to get some more of the juicy gossip to be able to tell, but you only heard us apologising to one another and telling one another that we loved each other deeply. Now, you might decide to miss out that bit of the incident because it's not as juicy as the blazing row bit of the story. That's a half-truth. I'd like to point out that this is just a story I used to illustrate my point. Shireen, I didn't have a blazing row on Wednesday afternoon. It was Tuesday afternoon. No, not really. Our marriage is perfect. You know, we don't have blazing rows. Instead, we have very loud conversations, as our kids used to call them when they were little. So thank you for your prayers for us. Now, the problem with telling half-truths is that they can lead us to think that we haven't actually told a lie at all. And when you think about it, some of the reasons why we tell half-truths, well, they're often in order to paint the other person we're telling a half-truth about in a bad light. Either that, or we tell a half-truth in order to paint ourselves in a good light, because telling the other half wouldn't paint us in as much of a good light, would it? And it's not just about us not telling half-truths. It's about us being wary of those times when we're being told half-truths by someone else. Because that's the problem with half-truths. Sometimes you're holding the wrong end, the wrong half. I think it's always wise when we suspect that we're being told half-truths to ask further questions in order to make a judgment about what we're being told. And if we're unsure, then perhaps give the person being spoken about the benefit of the doubt until we know otherwise. So there's outright lies, half-truths, and then there's gossip. Now, whilst not technically a lie, gossip can be one of those things closely linked to half-truths. The Oxford English Dictionary defines gossip as casual or unconstrained conversational reports about other people, typically involving details that are not confirmed as being true. In other words, gossip is sharing tales about someone without concern for either love or truth. The story is told about three Baptist ministers who went on a spiritual retreat together. And one day, while they were out walking, one of the ministers gets sharing some deep issues and insights that they're struggling in within their lives as Christians. And the first minister tearfully confesses about his pride and his anger in full graphic detail. And he urges the other two ministers to be similarly open and share their struggles too so they can all pray for one another. So the second minister confesses how for years he's struggled with lust and often fantasizes about the church secretary. The first two ministers then look to the third minister and for a long time he's silent. And then he finally speaks and he says, "Dear, dear brothers, if you really want to know my weakness and the area in which I regularly sin, then it's that I absolutely love to gossip and I can't wait to get back home and tell everybody what you said." The Bible strongly warns against gossip. Romans 1 verse 29 and 2 Corinthians 12 verse 20 both condemn gossip as a result of a depraved mind and as something unfitting for Christians to be involved in. And remember, it takes two to gossip, one to give it and one to receive it. And as Christians, we should refuse to listen to gossip. And if someone is seeking gossip from you, either give them good gossip that builds that other person up, or stay silent. Because the truth is that in an environment where gossip happens and goes unchecked, then it's most likely that no one is going to be prepared to be open and admit areas of their life that they struggle with and then therefore reach out to get help in those areas. It's impossible for there to be faith and trust in others when there's a culture of gossip. In the same way that many of our old pews that we used to have in here got removed in the recent refurbishment due to woodworm in them, gossip in the church is a little bit like social woodworm that quietly and slowly undermines all that we do and aim to be for the Lord. Another form of lie is the excuse. This kind of false witness is something all too common. We lie through the use of an excuse to divert blame or shame away from ourselves and onto someone or something else. It's like the teenage daughter having to explain to her father how the house got trashed while mum and dad were away for the weekend, and whether or not there'd been a wild party in the house. When the father says to the daughter, I want an explanation and I want the truth. And the daughter says to the dad, make your mind up, dad, you can't have both. The excuse is where we vehemently declare, it's not my fault, they did it, or they made me do it. The excuse was probably the first recorded lie in all of the Bible, in the Garden of Eden, in Genesis 3, verse 12. Adam said, it wasn't my fault, God, the one you gave to me, she made me do it. It's an excuse. It's a lie. We also see the demonstration that one lie is nearly always followed by another lie. Abraham Lincoln said, no one has a long enough memory to be a successful liar. When God asked Eve if Adam's account was true, her response was, wasn't my fault, the serpent made me do it. If it is someone else's fault, is the oldest lie in human history. And while we think that telling a lie in the form of an excuse might get us out of a tight spot, eventually a lie will always catch up with us. As the saying goes, lies cover over a multitude of sins, but only temporarily. Making excuses can actually also be doubly harmful. On the one hand, it harms someone else, you know, the one we pass the blame on to. But on the other hand, it stops us dealing with the issue or the problem that we had to lie about in the first place. Transferring our guilt prevents us from repenting and getting right with God and dealing with that by the fact that we go into a kind of denial mode. The Bible tells us that the only real solution to sin is to face up to God, to be truthful with him, to repent and seek God's forgiveness, which he freely gives if we mean it. Another subtle form of, a yet damaging form of lying, is the insinuation. Now, an insinuation is where you make up a statement that leads someone to think something that is not true. You've not told an outright lie. You may have not have even told a half truth. But instead, by insinuation, we're encouraging other people to come to the wrong conclusion. We knowingly provide the building blocks and we let the other person construct the lie for themselves. And the attraction of insinuation as a lie is it can be done so subtly that people don't even realize that's what we're doing. And because if someone comes back to you and accuses you of lying about that thing, you can confidently reply, oh, I didn't say that. Which on the surface of it, I guess would be true. But what we've actually done through an insinuation, is lie by stealth. And this is how it works. Say perhaps my mate Jim here, after a few months of looking for a new job, he finally gets a new job. And he's so excited about it, you know, so pumped up, ready to start his new job. And I know somebody else who works at the same company that Jim's about to start employment for. The next time I see this person who I know who works for the same company, I remark to that person how my mate Jim's just started working at the same place as him. And in the flow of the conversation, I might say, well, I really do hope Jim manages to stick at this job. And immediately that person starts to wonder if Jim has a problem with commitment and persevering in a job. He doesn't. Jim's a really hardworking guy. Just saying that. That person who I told and made that insinuation to, he tells a few more people at the same company, and in no time at all, Jim's bosses are wondering if they've done the right thing in employing such an unreliable person. Lies in the form of insinuation can be powerful things. Mark Twain remarked, a lie can travel halfway round the world while a truth is still putting its shoes on. Or as John F. Kennedy said, the great enemy of the truth is very often the lie. Not the deliberate, contrived or dishonest lie, but rather the myth, the persistent and persuasive insinuation. So as Christians, we need to be on our guard against insinuations, both making them and receiving them. I think insinuations can be stopped in their tracks by asking wise questions. What you have just said to me there sounds like you are suggesting this. Or did you mean to imply that? And the very last form of a lie is, I suspect, something that not many of us would imagine is actually a lie. Any guesses what it might be? That's right. Silence. Of all the forms I've mentioned, of all the forms of lying I've mentioned so far, they all use words in one way or another to bear false witness. But lying can also be done with silence as much as it can be done with words. In fact, the cruelest lies are often told in silence. Imagine you're at a work meeting or you're out with friends and someone says something hurtful or damaging about someone else that you know to be untrue. What do you do in that situation? Well, they haven't said it about me, so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut and not say anything. Or I'm not going to speak up because I don't want to get on the wrong side of the person who just said that thing. Or if I speak up and I challenge that lie by telling the truth, then that might negatively affect me in some way. So I'm just going to stay silent. It can be really difficult to do the right thing in these situations, can't it? Really difficult not to keep quiet, but rather to speak up for the truth. However, in God's eyes, it's always better to be divided by the truth than united in error. Better to speak the truth that hurts and then heals than to speak a lie that will comfort then kill. Better to be hated for telling the truth than be loved for telling a lie. Better to stand alone with the truth or be in the multitude by telling a lie. Better to die ultimately with the truth than live with a lie. And as with all the other boundaries that we've looked at within the Ten Commandments, this one too reveals something about the nature and character of God. And it's this, that the Lord is our witness. The Lord is our witness. 2 Chronicles 16 verse 9 says, "The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards him." As well as God being truth himself, God knows everything. Whereas in our law courts, most of their time in a court appearing, in a case appearing in court, the time is spent trying to figure out truth from lies, isn't it? That's what the jury is there for. But with God, there's no need for that. He already knows everything. It's completely pointless to lie to God. There's nothing hidden from his eyes. Every thought, every word, every action, every motive is seen by God. Jesus himself said in Luke 8 verse 17, he said, "One day, all that is secret will be brought out into the open. Everything that has been concealed will be brought to light and made known to all." In other words, the Lord is always watching, he's always looking, he's always searching the hearts of men and women. He is our ultimate witness. And we are promised that one day, complete truth will be made known. Is it any wonder that in a world that has denied God his rightful place as Lord over all, is now engulfed with lies and untruth? The idea that God might be watching everything we do and say probably makes all of us feel quite uncomfortable. But without this understanding, lies will flourish and damage will be done to society will be immense. It's like playing a football match and deciding to get rid of the referee and the rules, and then we wonder why the game seems to descend into complete senseless riot where the players get hurt. A bit like watching a West Ham versus Millwall match, but Graham isn't here to approve that or not. Our world desperately needs a God who will stand over all that we say and do. A supreme and sovereign God that one day we will need to give an account before. In doing some reading, preparing for this message this morning, I read an article bemoaning the widespread use of surveillance cameras here in the UK. Because although Britain has less than 1% of the world's population, you might be interested to know that it has more than 10% of the world's surveillance cameras. And as I reflected on this fact, initially I was quite supportive of this article's stance against such an invasion of our privacy. But when I started to reflect on it from a scriptural perspective of how the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards God, it made me think about the natural consequences of when we as a nation turn our backs on God and his commands. Because if you remove God from society in the way that we've done in Britain at the moment, then I guess the prevalence of things like surveillance cameras is probably a natural consequence of needing to find other ways of ensuring and upholding truth. At the heart of lying and untruthfulness is the issue of mouth management. The ability to manage our mouths well, wisely, and ultimately truthfully. Just because we can doesn't mean we should say it. It is said that the mouth is the door to whatever is in our hearts. Whatever is living in our hearts walks out through the front door of our mouths. Jesus, James' brother, tells us that the tongue has the ability to be a restless evil full of deadly poison. And he goes on to explain how the tongue is like the rudder of a ship, and that while it's tiny, it steers the course and sets the direction. You might be surprised to learn that the tongue makes up less than 0.04% of our body weight. But it can also be our greatest asset or our most destructive possession. Aesop, the famous teller of fables, was asked, "What's the most powerful thing in the world?" To which he replied, "The tongue." "And what is the most harmful thing in the world?" he was asked. Once more, he replied, "The tongue." When we consider this ninth commandment, not to bear false witness, not to tell lies. Now, because lies don't deal with things rather than words, we can therefore think that lying isn't as significant as breaking some of the other commandments we've looked at in this series. After all, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Has there ever been a more untrue thing ever said in the world? See, wounds can caused by words, but bones can heal in a relatively short space of time. But wounds caused by words or lies can take years to mend, if at all they ever do. We need to realize that our words, especially the lies we tell in whatever form that lie takes, are extremely significant. They have weight. They can damage relationship. They can ruin and destroy lives. They can stop people coming along to church. They can be a contributing factor in people falling away from the Lord. This is how serious breaking this command can be. And the best advice I've ever heard on this topic of how we speak to one another through our words is the use of this acrostic think. Now, I'm sure you've all heard this before, but I'm going to finish off and leave this with you. Before we say something, before we're tempted to tell a lie, consider these five things. Firstly, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? And is it kind? And if we can't answer yes to those questions, then perhaps we shouldn't be saying it.